I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. For over a century, generations of Americans have stood on the chalk-dusted floor of their elementary school classrooms, turned to face the flag, put their hands over their hearts, and said these words.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic of which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Now, the Supreme Court is hearing a case which will decide whether the pledge, in its current form, can stand. The phrase, one nation under God, which was inserted in 1954, has been challenged by the father of a schoolgirl in California. He says it crosses the line that's supposed to separate church and state. Now, this argument turns on interpretation. Some people say that the reference to God in the Pledge of Allegiance is simply an historical nod to America's religious heritage. Others believe otherwise. They say the phrase is a profession of faith that wrongly endorses the idea of America as a monotheistic nation. So, Connection listeners, what do you think? Is this a disagreement, a case of political correctness run amok? Or does the phrase, under God, truly cross that line between church and state? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to start today with the superintendent of the Elk Grove Unified School District in California, where this all began. David Gordon is joining us from Sacramento. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me what happens this morning in the school where this 9-year-old goes to her first class. Is the Pledge of Allegiance still being recited?
Yes, it is. Under a stay granted by the court pending review by the Supreme Court, the pledge is said in our elementary school classrooms as usual.
So despite the fact that the appeal court said it was unconstitutional, that stay means that until there's another ruling, it'll continue to be recited. Am I right?
That is correct.
And what about the kids? And I don't know how many of them there might be, David. Perhaps you can help me. But what about the kids whose parents don't want them to recite the Pledge of Allegiance? What happens in the classroom?
Under our state's law, a family has an absolute right to opt their child out of having to say the pledge if they're uncomfortable with the child doing so, or if the child is uncomfortable in doing so. And the teacher would make an arrangement which would best be sensitive to not making the child feel different or ostracized, and our staff is very good at doing that.
Does that mean that the kids would stand in the hall or in the cloakroom? How does it work?
It would be worked out with the family to provide a way that was comfortable for them and for the child, and I think the argument about, well, the child will feel horribly ostracized, I think in our system doesn't hold water, because we have in our district probably 30 or 40 religions. Children wear all manner of garb. We have children with special needs. And the teachers are very, very good at making sure children don't feel different or ostracized because of a particular belief. And I trust that they do that well.
So is it your view, David, that the opting out, as you've described it, is adequate in terms of dealing with anyone who has a reservation about the Pledge of Allegiance?
Well, let me put it this way. I've been around in this particular district for 12 years and have never heard a complaint about the process.
And you've got an interesting mix in your schools. You've got a lot of minority kids, a lot of English as a second language, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of religion. So it's kind of an interesting kitchen to study, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, it is, and for the rest of the country as well. We're 64% minority students. We have over 80 languages spoken in our district. As I mentioned, many, many religions. And one of the priorities of our Board of Education is we're responsible for helping children learn to live together with many, many other faiths and races and religions, and we take that very seriously. And I think our district, which is kind of half an urban, half a suburban district, is the future of America. This is what America will look like in 10, 15, 20 years.
And so how do you feel about the Supreme Court weighing in on this?
I think it's important that the Supreme Court clarify it once and for all, because this is an issue for the whole nation, not just the Elk Grove School District, and it would make no sense at all to ban the pledge for 10 million children in the Ninth Circuit and have everybody else saying the pledge. It's time that this this got clarified.
Let's bring Charles Haynes into the conversation. Charles is a senior scholar at the First Amendment Center. That's part of the Freedom Forum. He's been listening in. And Charles, this is an area that you study at some considerable length.
That's right. I spend my life on these kinds of issues. But let me first say that it's interesting that Elk Grove has gotten in the news for this when they should be in the news for being one of the outstanding school districts in California and the nation. I mean, they do a terrific job of education. I've had the privilege of working with some of their teachers and administrators. I know they take seriously how you deal with religion in the schools and how you protect the rights of all kids. So, you know, that's really a message that people should also know, so that Elk Grove just isn't just the place where we have the pledge mm-hmm. controversy. They have an outstanding superintendent and outstanding staff.
Charles, tell me whether or not you share David's point of view that it's perhaps a good thing to have the Supreme Court resolve this once and for all.
I suppose so. I mean, I think it's unfortunate that we have these kinds of lawsuits and fights in our country, and that we can't work these things out in other ways. But we've become, if you think baseball is the national pastime, it really isn't. It's litigation. We've become litigious and angry, and our public square has become quite hostile often. So unfortunately, that's often the way now we resolve these issues instead of working it out in other ways. And perhaps it is a good thing that finally the Supreme Court will say something about this question, which has kind of been bubbling under the surface. Of course, the Supreme Court, in taking this case, could easily duck the First Amendment issue, and may indeed do so, because the first question they have to decide is whether this parent has standing to even bring the case, because there's some question about the custody issue for the child and so forth. So if the Supreme Court decides that that Mr. Newdow does not have standing, then the case goes away, and we will not know what the court really thinks about the First Amendment part of the case.
Tell me how you see the substance of it, though, those two words, under God. Do you see that as the sort of ceremonial nod to American history, or do you see it as having greater weight?
This is a very difficult question for Americans, because we've had a long history of struggling with just how much reference to religion we should have in government proclamations and actions. And we've changed our minds, and we've gone back and forth. But I would say this, that if we went back to 1954 and looked at whether or not Congress should be in the business of adding under God to a pledge that had been said for many years without under God, Congress did it, of course, at the height of the Cold War, and a lot of anxiety in the country about communism and so forth, as you mentioned earlier. So it's understandable in that climate why that might happen. But it probably wasn't the right thing to do, because we, in 1954 even, were a very diverse nation. Many people who have no religious affiliation had no religious affiliation. And so for the government to weigh in at that point and change the pledge, probably if we had it all to do over again, that wasn't really consistent with our religious liberty principles in this country as we've developed them over the course of 200 years. Having said that, it's there. And it's been there now for some time. The question now is, does it really rise to the level of state establishment of religion, and or has it become just a kind of civil religion, some would call it, like Christmas is a national holiday and so forth, and doesn't really have much religious meaning? Is it more ceremonial deism, as others call it, which is just sort of a mention of religion in deference to our history and our traditions and so forth and so on?
What do you think, Charles? Which is it?
Well, I think that it has in many ways become that for many people, which is bad news for people who care about religion and God. If it has been drained of much of its meaning, and in polls, most Americans say that they see it just simply as a kind of traditional affirmation, historic phrase. They don't see it as religious. So I think it has been drained of religious meaning. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing for religion. But on the other hand, one has to say that there are people who do feel harmed by it, who do feel that it is government endorsement of religion and says that they're outsiders in their country. So I don't want to minimize the feelings that some Americans have about it. So whether I personally think it's very harmful or not is probably beside the point. The question is, will the court see this as rising to the level of state endorsement of religion? And the answer is, Probably not.
David Gordon, in Sacramento, California, when this comes up with teachers and parents and students, is that the head-scratching part of the debate? What do those words mean? How should the pledge be seen? Does that conversation that Charles is describing reach down to the grassroots level?
In some instances it does, but realistically I think the vast majority of the public and parents, from what we have heard in our community, feel that it does not force religion on children, and that really it is a recognition of the role of religion in the history of our country rather than something that would compel anyone to believe in the existence of God or to even recognize religion in general. And then there is the, as I mentioned at the top of the show, there is the opt-out clause, which gives, an open opportunity to say, we don't want to engage in this.
Are you closer to the first feeling that you described, the idea that it doesn't necessarily say or put a child in a position where they're embracing religion by reciting the pledge?
Yeah, I believe that's the case. I think the opt-out clause goes a large step further to say that if you do feel that way, you have an opportunity not to engage in it at all. If you don't want to hear the words, they can make an arrangement where you don't even have to hear the pledge. But I think, again, that's the majority of the opinion in our community. Now, that's not to say, obviously, this mm-hmm. will have to be and should be decided on the law, but there's a large body of prior decisions in circuit courts and even the words of the Supreme Court that affirms that position. The Sherman case in 1992 was a Seventh Circuit case where, in effect, they affirmed the constitutionality of the pledge, and the Supreme Court denied review upon appeal.
And Charles Haynes, we'll be speaking in just a couple of moments with Jim Henderson with the American Center for Law and Justice, and that's an organization, among many others, that likes the pledge exactly the way it is. When you apply the test of the First Amendment, is there any question in your mind? I mean, is the First Amendment itself meant to be ambiguous?
I think in the beginning our framers were deeply divided over exactly what no establishment would mean in this country. Some thought it would mean really keeping government out of religion almost entirely, while others thought it would still allow the states to have their own establishments. So from the beginning we've been divided about this, and our history has been fraught with conflict about it. Though the good news is that I think even those people divided then and people divided now generally do support no establishment. They don't want the government telling us what to do in religion. They don't want the government imposing religion. However, we disagree about what that looks like and whether these kinds of references to religion by government do, in fact, break down that principle of no establishment, which protects all of us in our religious liberty. So I think that, you know, the question now today is, you know, how... It's unfortunate we have to fight about it, but we're not fighting about the core principle. What we're fighting is around the edges. You know, does this really attack our religious liberty in some fundamental way?
Connection listeners, how do you see that very question? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And this hour we're talking about the bubbling back up of the controversy over the Pledge of Allegiance, that those two words, under God, and the fact that a California parent has pushed this now all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States for a determination on whether the use of the word God or one nation under God crosses that line that is meant to separate church and state in this country. With us on the program, Charles Haynes. He's senior scholar with the Freedom Forum's First Amendment Center. David Gordon, superintendent of the school district in California where this began. Charles, though, let me just return to you briefly, if I can, before I introduce my next guest, because you've spoken earlier about being a little concerned that there could be a backlash here that if the court were to rule, you know, this none of this is worth arguing about, we're just going to take God out of everything, take in God we trust off the money and take, you know, under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance and so help me God out of the court system, get rid of it all. You're worried that there could be a backlash there. Do you want to describe what your concern is?
Sure. I think there are two slippery slopes possible here, and I think the court, frankly, will, the justices are going to think about both of them. I mean, the first one is, of course, if you allow under God, and somehow that will erode the Establishment Clause, and then we will allow more and more government endorsement of religion. I don't think that most of these justices will see that as a slippery slope that we're likely to go down. I mean, these were the same court that has struck down football prayer, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we're that's the danger. The other slippery slope, however, is that if under God is stricken out of the pledge, at least in public school recitation, that we will somehow then go down the slope of removing all references to deity and God from our national life, from our ceremonies. I mean, goodness, the Star-Spangled Banner's last stanza has "In God We Trust" in it. And that slippery slope and that fight will, in fact, I think, no question, create a huge backlash in this country. We saw after the Ninth Circuit decision the backlash that was created and the furor. And that might very well lead to a constitutional amendment that would change the Establishment Clause and in some ways allow more government affirmations and endorsements of religion than we have now under these references to religion, the current law. So I think that there are some justices, at least, who are for a strong Establishment Clause that are going to be very concerned about that potential for going down the road where popular opinion and public opinion, not that they should decide it on that, but mm-hmm. I think that is a factor because it could erode our fundamental principles of religious liberty.
Let's hear from Jim Henderson. He's senior counsel with the American Center for Law and Justice. It's a public interest law firm writing an amicus brief to the Supreme Court in support of keeping the Pledge of Allegiance as it is right now. He's joining us from Washington. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know a large part of your concern is the procedural one that we talked about a little bit earlier, whether or not, in fact, the father has standing. But let's cut right to the substance of this, the use of those two words, under God. We just heard Charles describe a situation where people might get so fed up with these things being pushed back to the courts that they might actually, there might be enough support in this country for a new constitutional amendment that would say, enough arguing about it. We're going to use the word God, and this is how it's going to be used. What do you think about that?
I think Charles is not far from the mark. If you recall, while Bill Clinton was president in 1995, he went over to Virginia across the river from the White House and made a pronouncement regarding the rights of students to engage in religious activities in the public schools. When that occurred, was a period of time following a Supreme Court decision in 93 about prayer at graduation, and with a great deal of foment following that decision regarding the rights of students in schools to be religious. When it occurred, there was an ongoing press at the time for an amendment to the Constitution regarding the meaning of the Establishment Clause and freedom of religion. I think that in that circumstance, I don't know whether he deliberately did it. I just have a suspicion that he probably saw the wisdom of riding that tide and answering that constituency with, frankly, what was a very good statement about the large scope of the rights of students in the public schools to be religious and be in the public schools. Wouldn't surprise me if there was such a backlash here.
Tell me how you see this particular controversy. Do you see it as an assault on religion in America, or do you see it as a misguided bit of political correctness trying to tidy up language?
Well, I know we're trying to avoid personalities, and I'll do my best, but the fact is this case has to be understood in the larger context of a man who has never met a supposed violation of the Establishment Clause that he hasn't found a way to get into court. We're talking about a man who challenges prayer at presidential inaugurations and the paid chaplaincy in the United States Congress, despite the fact that the Supreme Court has made clear that paid chaplaincies in state legislatures are perfectly constitutional because the practice was observed in the federal Congress at the time the First Amendment was passed. So,
all right, that's the California parent, Michael.
That's the California parent. But so you have to take it from there. The case itself, whether or not the mere words under God, I think I realize there are many issues that may be more meaningful, things like, can I get a voucher to send my kid to private school, to some people. But because of the arguments that are made about whether or not the words under God can be a violation of the Establishment Clause, takes us right to the heart of the meaning of the Establishment Clause, I don't think there's any more important thing for the Supreme Court to clarify at this time.
And so you see this as a substantial argument, as despite the reasons for it getting to court, that you're saying there is value in having the Supreme Court rule on this as a matter of continuing the precedent of defining the First Amendment.
I think there's two values. First of all, there is the value that comes from identifying justices of the Supreme Court who do not feel particularly connected to the actual terms of any document, statute, or rule that they are called upon to enforce or construe. So in other words, I've prejudged this matter. I guess that was Justice Scalia's problem in this case. I've prejudged this matter, and I've concluded that the words under God simply cannot violate the Establishment Clause. I think it'll be helpful to know which justices of the Supreme Court think that it is an Establishment Clause problem, and more importantly, what possible reading of the Establishment Clause, which has an actual text and has an actual meaning, in our view, could justify that view. Very important on that level.
Well, what's sad about this to me is that, you know, when we have these rulings that allow some religious expression and by government, a creche as long as it's surrounded by reindeer and Santa Claus and so forth, that really, I think religion loses. And so, you know, I think that the sad end of the story, which whatever, however it comes out, is, you know, authentic religion loses when the government takes it and uses it for its own purpose, in my view. I guess I'm an old Roger Williams fan here. I don't think the government should have any business proclaiming religion one way or another. For one reason, I think it really does hurt religious expression to be drained of its meaning in this way and to be used by the state. And in fact, the Supreme Court over the years, whenever they refer to under God or in God we trust and so forth in their various prayer decisions, as Jim well knows, many of the justices have said, well, you know, it no longer has any religious meaning. It's been drained of its religious meaning. It's just, you know, just a phrase. It doesn't harm anyone. I think it's a sad day when that's the only way that people think they can get religion in public life is by putting it in government proclamations and exercises and then ending with it being drained of any meaning. So that's why I guess, you know, in my heart of hearts, I wish that government would stay out of this and protect the people's right to express their faith in all kinds of ways. I'm all for that. But I just don't see this push to somehow get government to co-opt a religious expression.
Let's hear from a couple of our callers. Bruce has been waiting on the line. He's calling in from Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I think the whole situation is extremely interesting. I question why some of these people, even when they have the opportunity to opt out, why they chase after the issue to the point of animosity, contempt, even hatred. And I've reflected on this for some time. And whether you're addressing In God We Trust or the Pledge of Allegiance or the Ten Commandments, why this incredible hatred towards it?
Why do you characterize it as hatred, Bruce?
Because so many people, it's with such a vengeance that they go after it. And I've reflected on this systemically for some time now. And when you address the issues of separation of church and state, take, for instance, the Ten Commandments with Judge Moore down there, and I believe it's Alabama. If he has the Ten Commandments in the rotunda, can they influence the state financially? No. Can they influence the state legislatively? No. The only way the presence of God in our secular world can influence our society is morally. And there's the threat. A lot of people don't want to have to be reminded of the presence of any type of a superior power or a deity. And I think personally, I think it's a mistake, because if we ever needed an increase in moral beliefs and reminders, it's now.
So, Bruce,
I think the problem in Alabama is that many people feel that Judge Moore has a larger agenda in how he wants to interpret the law based on his biblical views. And I think that's the concern folks have. They're not just the monument in the courthouse. And I think in this case, you know, it cuts both ways. I mean, let's face it, atheists in this country are beat up on as much more as anybody else. And I don't think they bring it all on themselves. I think we do have a problem in this country with really being careful to see that people are citizens, even if they don't have a religious affiliation, even if they are self-proclaimed atheists, that they too are American citizens and have rights. And they need to raise their hand and say, you know, we feel like an outsider in our country. Often we look around and we see government saying all of these things about religion. We feel like outsiders. Now, I kind of agree with the call, in the sense that I don't really think we ought to take these things to court and try to wipe out all of these references myself. But I do feel very deeply that the backlash against people like Mr. Newdow says something very ugly about our country, that we can't respect his right and respect who he is as a citizen, but we have to have hate calls and all kinds of terrible things. He's been the subject of all kinds of terrible abuse since
Bruce, let me hear from you on that.
Well, you have your private areas, each individual's space, and yet there's this gray area, this wide area of ambiguity in between that we call the public space. And I think it's interesting that any time an individual wants to use the word God or define their particular tradition in a public space, especially on any type of public property, immediately the valedictorian at a high school is going to be censured and threatened with expulsion if she uses the word God at a presentation on the football field. How come is it, and I ask this as a question, is it that religion always takes a back seat to the First Amendment of freedom of speech?
You can, well, you know, I'm with you there, Bruce.
I will not take a second chair to Charles on being concerned for Mr. Newdow's safety or being concerned that people who engage in this debate treat him with appropriate respect. But the fact of the matter is that in our country, for, well, 60 years now, we have drawn the appropriate balance with respect to this particular exercise, the pledge. There is not a single person in the United States who is required to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. It is a voluntary exercise. No one is made to do it. The school district here has a policy of using the pledge to satisfy a state law requirement that there be a patriotic exercise in the morning. But, and that state law identifies the pledge as one way of doing it, but no student is made to say the
pledge. Jim Henderson, do you agree with Bruce that this particular case involving the Pledge of Allegiance is part of a larger move, including the Ten Commandments controversy from Alabama and school prayer?
Yes, and here's why. As I indicated, Mr. Newdow himself is quite a mover and shaker in the world of questionable litigation. He's challenged a number of practices and, for the most part, has been unsuccessful in his efforts. There are these other cases, the Ten Commandment cases. What characterizes them to me, and I prefer not to engage in personal attacks, so I won't, but what characterizes these things to me, though, is the rank cowardice of the folks who think that these references to God and allusions to the Christian origins of America should be swept from the public domain, because they never take it home to the Supreme Court of the United States, where if you go today and sit and watch the court argue, you will see Chief Justice Rehnquist sitting squarely underneath a carving which has two tables and is numbered from 1 through 10.
The Roman numerals, we don't know quite what that means. But.
Well, of course we don't know quite what 10 unnumbered things is. If you take the tour of the Supreme Court, they tell you that plaque with the numbers 1 through 10 in Roman numerals is meant to symbolize moral laws common to all early civilizations.
I suspect, Jim Henderson, that you could take the position that the California parent has taken and say that, you know, because he's out there, it's an example of the reverse of cowardice, that he's taking a rather courageous stand. But I don't actually really
– I
don't want to argue both sides of that. I do want to go back to David.
I want to agree with Bruce for a minute, because I think that we have to show there's common ground here about these issues. I mean, I think Bruce is right, and Jim too. I mean, to raise the question of whether religious expression and religious – people are adequately protected in our public square. And I think sometimes it's not. But the confusion is between when government, in my mind at least, that I think there's a confusion between when government is promoting and endorsing religion and when we protect the rights of people to express themselves. I think that valedictorian has a right to mention her faith in her speech. She doesn't have a right to take over and give a long sermon, but she has a right to talk about her faith. I think that should be protected. I think in many ways we have gone so far in fighting about this and giving the message to many religious people that they are not welcome in our schools, that they're not welcome in the public square, that we have this backlash. The unfortunate thing is that when people have this backlash and use the government to bring religion in, it's the wrong tactic. The right way to think about it is, how can we make the public square a place where people are treated with fairness and respect, where religious expression is protected, but where we keep the government out of it? That doesn't do religion any good, and it doesn't really protect the religious liberty of the individuals in our country.
Let's just hear from David Gordon here, the superintendent in California, because while you said earlier, David, that this is not a controversy that consumes the time of people at the water cooler necessarily, I'm wondering whether or not the focus on this is something that's used in the classroom, that people are taking this issue and saying, oh, well, okay, this is the way the country works or is supposed to work or isn't working.
It certainly is a good opportunity to do that. Let me just comment again on Mr. Newdow's objection to the pledge. I think the issue here is not that Mr. Newdow or perhaps others are offended by Under God in the pledge. It's not – we certainly acknowledge that and are sensitive and respectful of his belief. The question – I think Charles hit the nail on the head – is not that he's offended. It's, how do you cure the offense that he feels? And I think our point of view would be, it certainly doesn't need to be taken to the Supreme Court, because we have a way through the opt-out or whatever, because taken to its illogical extreme, when you look at all of the other things we teach about in the schools, namely the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Gettysburg Address, the National Anthem, the National Motto, to name just a few, they are all laced with references to God, and believe it or not, parents can opt out from having their children confront those documents if they see fit, and I think that cures that problem.
All right, a chance to say thanks to Jim Henderson for being with us. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Jim Henderson, Senior Counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice. Connection listeners, should this question or controversy about the Pledge of Allegiance, the use of those words, one nation under God, go all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States? Do we need to have each one of these things ruled upon by the highest judges in the land? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Lots of ideas, lots of different interpretations of a case which is now, as of just yesterday, going to the Supreme Court of the United States for a ruling on whether or not the words "one nation under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance are taking the public school recitation of that too close to the line separating church and state. 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you. Let's go next to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tom's joining us. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
I just want to say, I think that it is disingenuous to say that children aren't forced to say the pledge. I mean, you imagine a 10-year-old child sitting in the classroom, and the teacher stands up and says, you know, good morning, now it's time to say the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, it's true that there are these opt-out things in which a child has to sort of intentionally remove themselves from the society of children that they're in order to do that. And I just think that the pledge has to be looked at differently from, you know, striking "in God we trust" from money or other types of things, because this is a definite positive coercion of children. You know, they're not being forced in the usual sense of the word, but there's no question that there is a conversion, a coercion, and there will be a desire to be part of the community, to conform, to fit in. I mean, that's just natural.
Tom, just stay with me. I want to hear from David Gordon on this, because that's something I know, David, that you're trying to make sure there isn't coercion. But I mean, Tom makes a point. You got one kid out of 30 who's sitting on his or her hands at the back of the class once a day. There's pressure there.
I think the caller makes a theoretical good argument, but I think in reality, you have to test that argument against, look in one of our classrooms, see how staff handles those kinds of situations. We have children that are wearing all manner of religious garb because that reflects their belief. We have children with profound differences who are made to feel comfortable and live together. So my response to that is come to one of our schools, see how we do business.
Tom.
I mean, the caller also makes a point in the sense that the Supreme Court in the past has been stricter in these cases concerning religion when it comes to public schools for some of those very reasons. The court has allowed prayers before Congress and legislators, for example, as we heard earlier, but has struck down state-sponsored prayers in a public school, precisely because we're dealing with a captive audience of impressionable young people.
So are you agreeing with Tom then, Charles?
Well, I think Tom is raising a very good issue. I don't think that this court will see this as a coercive exercise. I may be wrong. I think they will see this as something that is a minimal harm. And that doesn't say that people who feel harmed by it are not to be respected, but I think that that's probably the prevailing sentiment. I doubt they will put this on the level of state prayer, state Bible reading, even though I know that there are some people who feel it is on that level. The larger question, of course, is what kinds of patriotic exercises should we be requiring in our public schools, and what does it do for our country, and is it necessary? Is it coercive to have patriotic exercises of this nature anyway? My hope is that behind this, we have a real look at what we're doing to help citizens to understand the principles of the country and the values of their country.
Sort of reach an absurd level then, Charles? Wouldn't it then be coercive to people who are sitting at a baseball game and told to stand and sing God Bless America halfway through the seventh inning? I mean, how do you define coercion? It's I guess, the first of the slippery slopes that you were talking about.
Well, of course, in that setting, that you know, those are citizens, and that's not the government telling them to do it, and they don't have to do it. But in a classroom, we're talking about government schools. We're talking about taxpayer-supported schools, and kids have to go to school. Compulsory attendance mm-hmm. laws; they have to be there. And so, I do think it's a special setting. These are young people; these are not adults out in the public square. I do think before we even start to think about saying the pledge, whether it has under God in it or not, we should really help students to understand what the meaning of the words are, what our flag is about, what our principles are. And I know some school districts, like Elk Grove, try to do a good job of really preparing the ground. Because if kids understand those principles, when somebody does opt out of the pledge, and many opt out of the pledge even before it had under God in it, right. When they do opt out, the rest of the students respect that and understand that and treat that
Charles,
as good
citizens.
Charles,
let me stop you. I do want to try and get a couple more of our callers in. So let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina next. Jeffrey's with us. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you for having me. My question is, isn't it more or less a foregone conclusion that for those that wish for our government to acknowledge God, that the ruling in either case will be a disappointment, because if A, they rule it must be stricken from the pledge, then that would be a disappointment. And B, due to the typical interpretation of not establishing a religion as total separation of church and state, if they allow it to stay, the opinion will likely be, because it's historical and it doesn't really mean anything at all. So isn't it more or less a disappointment for those who would like to see our government, acknowledge the presence of a God in our services, in our government ceremonies, you should say.
What about it, Charles? I mean, it's a way of looking at this that you can't have it both ways. You can't say that a reference to God is just a bit of ceremonial deism in a court of law, and then say philosophically, but it has great importance.
I think that's right. I think the caller is on the mark there, because I think religious people who care about God and care about their faith lose, however this comes out. Because any time we push for the engine of government to be involved religion, in my opinion, and we push that in the courts, the courts eventually, if they keep it, have to change it into something else. So it's not religious anymore. Jesus and the creche become a secular symbol with Santa Claus and reindeer. What is gained by that? That's why I say that, you know, in the first place, religious people should be really working to protect religious expression in the public square by citizens, but they shouldn't be pushing for the government to adopt religion, because that only leads to great disappointment and even really undermining authentic faith.
Jeffrey,
so I think the call is right.
Yeah, Jeffrey,
the speaker just articulated much better than I my exact feeling.
What do you think, Jeffrey? Do the words themselves matter?
They do to me individually, and that's what's important. As long as the government doesn't force someone to say those words, I think we are respecting everyone. And, you know, I don't want the government to carry it too far either way. I think they've struck a reasonable balance. For example, I wouldn't endorse, a stated Christian prayer in school, although I'm a Christian, because there may be students in that classroom who aren't Christian. Mm-hmm. However, I would absolutely endorse a time of silence for each individual to have their own religious expression. I think our government's job is to protect our right to express our religious views, and not to enforce or remove our ability to do either. They shouldn't enforce this. They shouldn't force others to participate, and they shouldn't restrict those who wish to participate from participating.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255, Lexington, Massachusetts now. Anne's joining us. Hi, Anne.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because, back in 1949, had the great honor of being chosen to lead my school in saying every week before the assembly the Pledge of Allegiance.
And this was the Pledge of Allegiance before it had the words under God.
Before it had the prayer, exactly. Right. And this was just after the end of the world of World War II. I think all of us, in fact, there were some veterans in our class, men who had gone to war and then come back and finished high school. The words meant something to us, and the flag meant something to us. I myself, at that time, I was 17 years old. I'm pretty sure I would have had a hard time saying under God. Either I would have said to myself, oh, well, it's just the same thing as saying the words on a coin, it doesn't mean anything. Or I would have said to myself, be hypocritical, go along with it. This is an honor. You want to be up on the stage saying these words. But when you really say them, you don't believe them, because I did not. I would not have. I don't think the people you are talking to, some of them, would want to put a student through that kind of inner turmoil. It's not right. I don't think those words belong in the pledge. The pledge can mean something. It can be very powerful, but those words don't belong there. It's not part of our American history.
And the man who wrote it said in commenting after the fact that what he wanted to get at more than anything else is the allegiance to the flag and the republic for which it stands.
Exactly.
When we have the argument that we're having about the place of the words under God, does it also serve to kind of confuse the real reason for the pledge? Do we lose sight of the allegiance and the republic in an argument over God?
I believe so. Absolutely. Because part of the reason for the founding of this country was religious freedom. A major part of the founding of this country was religious freedom.
Let's hear from David Gordon in California. David, if the Supreme Court were to decide that the words under God need to be removed, and you were saying earlier in the program that you'd just like to have this resolved one way or the other, would we just go on with the Pledge of Allegiance without those words as if there hadn't been the controversy? Or do you think that there'd be some new way of pecking away at it in your classrooms, a conversation about evolution or a conversation about something else?
Well, I can't say for certain, because that would have to be considered by our Board of Education, who would have several options. They could continue with the pledge minus the words under God, or as allowed by state law, they could substitute some other patriotic observance, a song, a poem, perhaps. So I couldn't say what they would do. But what I can say is this is a fine teachable moment for our kids, that a person with an unpopular point of view gets to bring it forward. And unlike most other countries, we don't fight about it in the streets. We settle it in the courts. And one thing we're planning to do to help our children better understand what's gone on is we're going to sponsor an essay contest, have two of our high school students write on each side of the issue. We'll judge the entries. And then if we can get tickets for the oral arguments, bring the two students back to live the oral arguments, and then come back and talk to their peers about how the system works from start to finish.
I think that's such a great idea, and I just want to say where I started, and that is that, you know, we need superintendents like David Gordon around the country, because there are many superintendents that frankly wouldn't take the time to make this a teachable moment, or would just say, this is what we're going to do, and not care about the rights of the minority or the conscience of the people in the community. But really what public schools should be all about is what he's just described. It should be about where we learn what it means to be good citizens that respect the rights of others, that care about the principles behind the flag. So let me just second that. This is a great teachable moment, not just in our schools, but in our country. Let's not have the same kind of hate that we had after the Ninth Circuit decision, however the court goes. Instead, why can't we as a nation think about how we can work together and live together, protect religious expression appropriately in the public square? And I think people on the other side of this who want to get rid of Under God and so forth have to come forward and say, we're not trying to say that religion doesn't have a place in public life. What we're trying to do is keep our government from imposing it on us. Let's have a conversation about that and not just have this notion that somehow you either choose between wiping all religion out of schools and the public life, or the government comes in and imposes it. Those are not the two choices. There is the third choice, which David is trying to create in his school district, and I think we need to create in the public square of America.
And in Lexington, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Do you see this as a useful moment, simply because it's a country that can have this kind of debate and argument?
Oh, absolutely. And I like the idea that yes, this is something that can be discussed in schools with children, but not imposed upon them. That's the important thing. It must not be imposed upon them.
Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
And David Gordon, I want to thank you for being with us as well.
You're most welcome. Pleasure to be with you.
David, Superintendent of Elk Grove United School District in Sacramento, California, Charles Haynes, nice to have you on the program again.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Charles is a senior scholar with the Freedom Forum's First Amendment Center. Earlier in the program, we also heard from Jim Henderson. He's senior counsel with the American Center for Law and Justice. Our program is produced by Khalil Bird, Nancy Cohen, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our intern is Sarah Ligon. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.